Welcome to Tanya 200, the conclusion, the highlights. The Tanya is basically an instruction book on how to serve God correctly, honestly, with heart and soul. But in the course of the first 53 chapters of the Tanya, there were incidental teachings that we derive from the text that touch on a variety of subjects, giving us an original and unique insight into these areas of life. Let's pick, for example, right at the beginning. Right at the start of Tanya, the Rebbe asks the following question. There's a statement in the Torah where Moses says to the Jewish people, what God is asking of you to serve him is not distant, it's not in heaven, it's not unreachable, it's not on the other side of the ocean, it is very close to you in your mouth and in your heart to do. And the Rebbe's question is, if we're talking to all the people, how is it true that serving God is a matter close to your heart? We see, in fact, that the nature of the human heart is the opposite of godly. It doesn't serve God. It doesn't love God. It doesn't fear God. It has other fears. And it certainly has other loves. Not the love of God. So to get your heart to love and fear God is not a simple matter. It does seem otherworldly. It does seem like you have to go through a major transformation, and it's like being in heaven or on the other side of the ocean. It's a big trip. It's a long journey. So that's the Rebbe's question. And in the course of the 53 chapters of Tanya, the Rebbe answers the question. But the very fact that this question bothers the Rebbe is a lesson in itself. Because what we see from it is that the Rebbe takes every statement in Torah as relevant and applicable to every generation and to every person. Otherwise, the question wouldn't bother him. If we could dismiss the statement as some kind of a poetic sentiment, Moshe was being a little generous, he was being a little unrealistic, maybe he was talking about his own heart, not so much anybody else's heart. If we could accept any of those attitudes or approaches, then there would be no question. The fact that the Rebbe was bothered by the question means that every statement in Torah must be understood as divine truth, which means literally true, not in some mystical way. It must be true at all times, not only for the days of Moses or the days the prophets roamed the earth, and it must be true of everyone, not only of the select few of every generation. And that itself is a vital lesson in how to study Torah. Let's pick another concept, the concept of humility. Early on in Tanya, the Rebbe asks the following question. What is a person who is neither a saint nor a sinner? Who is this person described in the Talmud as being in between the saint and the sinner? Could it possibly be a person who does many good things but also does many bad things? So he's not a saint because he sins half the time, but he's not a sinner because he's good half the time? Is that what it means? The Rebbe says, no, it can't mean that. It can't mean that because one of the sages, Rabbah, was teaching his students about these three different kinds of people, and he said, I, for example, am a Beinoni. What do we see from this? That a Beinoni cannot possibly be a person who is half bad, because Rabbah, we all know, was a saint. So if he said about himself that he was a Beinoni, an in-between, this in-between person must be really special for Rabbah to be able to use himself as an example. it certainly can't be a person who's half bad, because Rabbah couldn't possibly have mistaken himself, misread himself so grossly as to say that he is half bad when in fact he had never sinned. Now, the conventional approach would be Rabbah may have been a saint, and a Beinoni may be someone who sins half the time. And Rabbah used himself as an example of a part-time sinner because he was humble. And out of his humility, he described himself as a Beinoni, even though in fact he was a tzaddik. So where is the Rebbe's proof that a Beinoni can't possibly be someone who sins half the time? So we see from this that the Rebbe does not accept the idea that in humility you may deny the facts, that a humble person lies about himself, distorts reality. Humility does not permit falsehood. Humility does not mean denying who you are, what you're capable of. That's not humble, that's dishonest. That's distorted. Humility means knowing full well your greatness, your talent, your ability, your uniqueness, because they're true, and at the same time, taking no credit for any of it. So arrogance doesn't mean feeling capable or even superior. If you are superior in whatever area, whatever field, if you are a superior musician, you should know it. And you shouldn't hesitate to state it when it's relevant. And don't be talking about it all the time, but when it's relevant, you should say, I am the superior musician. If that's in fact true. Where then does the humility fit in? Given that you are a superior musician, or superior in whatever other area, given that talent, given that advantage, given that superiority, does that mean that you're a more worthy human being? Does that mean that you're a more deserving human being? Does that mean that you are more entitled to life? The humble person doesn't think so. The arrogant person does. So humility means, I know what I'm capable of, I know where I stand, I know my virtues as well as my weaknesses, but these virtues don't entitle me. They indebt me, if there's such an expression. I am indebted because of these talents, not entitled. Why did I deserve to have this talent? Why was I given this advantage? Why was I given this superiority? I didn't earn it. I don't deserve it. And so it humbles me. It makes me feel indebted rather than superior or more entitled or more of a human being than anybody else, which is a whole different view of humility, an honest humility. There's another interesting subject that the Rebbe touches on. Martyrdom. Self-sacrifice. Most of us assume that self-sacrifice means that if you're devoted to something, if you're committed to something, if you are deeply attached to a certain way of life or to a certain principle in life, then if you're threatened, if that quality of life or that doctrine is threatened, you are willing to risk your life, to sacrifice your life, to die for the cause. That's martyrdom. Not by the Alter Rebbe, not in Tanya. That kind of self-sacrifice really isn't very selfless at all. The person who is loyal to his commitments, the person who is devoted to his own doctrine, is pursuing his life, not sacrificing his life. And even if he dies in that pursuit, what he is pursuing is the life that he chose for himself, the doctrine that he believes in, the principles that he has committed himself to, and if he's willing to die for them, it's because he is continuing to pursue his life even under the threat of death. That's not self-sacrifice. That's self-preservation. If you refuse to buckle, if you refuse to discard a value because someone is trying to force you to, if you refuse to do that, that's called self-preservation, not self-sacrifice, even if you die doing it. Real self-sacrifice, the true meaning of self-sacrifice, means when you give up your life for something that was not your life. It was not what you had based your existence on. It's not what you excelled in. It's not what you're famous for. It's not what you lived your life for. It's someone else's issue. It's someone else's need, someone else's doctrine, someone else's belief, and you're dying for it. Well, why do you die for someone else? That's called sacrifice of self, not preservation of self. And that's why real martyrdom is demonstrated not by the saints, not by the sages who were willing to die for Judaism, not by the rabbis who would die rather than bow to an idol or work on Shabbos or eat non-kosher food. Genuine self-sacrifice was displayed by the simple, alienated, non-practicing Jew who was told to give up his Jewish identity or bow to an idol or die, and they wouldn't bow. Now, where did that come from? It's not that they had devoted their lives to observing commandments. In fact, they violate commandments all their life. And yet, when it comes to bowing to the idol, they can't do it. They can't do it. It's not that they prefer not to, but they can't. Because the awareness that this is something God cannot tolerate does not allow them to do it. Now, of course, we can ask, if they are so sensitive to what God can't tolerate, how is it that they violate the other commandments which God cannot tolerate? And the answer is simply that they have convinced themselves, irrationally, that the other commandments, although God may not like them, God can tolerate them. But idolatry he can't tolerate. Where they got that from? It's their own imagination. And although it's true that idolatry is one of the biggies, it's one of the big violations, it's possibly even the ultimate violation, because it's a denial of God. But in essence, anytime you do something God doesn't like, it's a denial of God. So it's an irrational distinction between one commandment and another, as if we know what God cares about more, or what he cares about less, or that anything he cares about can be less than absolute. If God cares about something, he only knows one way. he does things only one way, infinitely. So if he cares about something, he cares about it infinitely. So how can he care about two things to different degrees when he cares about everything infinitely? So it's an irrational mindset that allows a person to violate other commandments, but cannot bring himself to violate idolatry, not because it bothers him, not because he doesn't believe in the idol, but because he knows how much it bothers God. So that's true martyrdom. True martyrdom doesn't mean I prefer to die. I refuse to live without my freedom. I refuse to live without my religion. I refuse to live without my cow. People have died for their cow. That's not martyrdom. That's self-preservation. Martyrdom means you're giving me a choice I can't make. So to tell me to either bow to the idol and live, or be shot and die, I don't see a choice. I can't bow to the idol and live, so there's no choice here. It's like asking me whether I want to die or I want to die. So it's an involuntary thing. Martyrdom means not when I choose death. Martyrdom means when I see no choice. Another subject. Love. To love another human being. To be able to love someone, anyone. Of all the things that are said about love, here's what the Tanya tells us is a prerequisite. What enables a human being to love another human being? Not in a selfish, possessive way, which is easy, but in a true, genuine love. The Rebbe says that what enables us to love another person is our ability to dismiss ourselves. To the degree that I can dismiss myself, to that degree I can love another person. The Rebbe puts it this way. There is the personal me, the character that makes me me. That's associated with the body, because each individual personality comes with the individual body. Every body has its own unique fingerprints. Every body has its own unique character. Just as their faces are not alike, their minds are not alike, the Talmud says. So we have differences of opinion, differences of character, differences in tastes, because we are created physically different from each other. If I am enamored, if I am in love with that part of myself, then I am incapable of loving anybody else at all. Because if I love the part of me that makes me me, then I can't love the part of you that makes you you. Because the me and the you are not the same. They're not compatible. The person who loves that part of himself, the part that makes him him, can love another person only if they share a common interest, a common goal. I can love someone because something about that other person helps me attain my goal, helps me get what I want. And it doesn't have to be something as grubby as money. It can also be someone who helps me grow, who helps me become more of all the good things I want to be. So even the person who has a moral effect on me, a beneficial moral effect, who teaches me, who enlightens me, who elevates me to a higher level, brings out the most noble within me, I don't really love them. I love the effect they have on me. If they stop having that effect, I will stop loving them. So it's a love with an ulterior motive. Genuine love, to actually love the person and not the results or the effect, you have to dismiss the part of you that makes you you and love the part of yourself that everyone has. A Jew has to be in love with the Jew in him, with what makes me Jewish. I have to be in love with being a Jew. If I'm in love with being a Jew, then I naturally, and without any ulterior motive, love anyone else who is also a Jew. Because if I love the Jew in me, then I love the Jew in every Jew. Because that's not what separates us. That's what we have in common. That's what we are in common. So it's not that the other Jew helps me be a Jew or enhances my Jewishness. It's just that in loving the Jew in me, I am automatically also loving the Jew and everybody else. And that's the deeper meaning of love your neighbor as yourself. As yourself doesn't mean as much as yourself, as intensely as you love yourself, or in the same way that you love yourself. You know, you express your self-love by feeding yourself, And so you should express your love of others by feeding them. That's not what as yourself means. Love your neighbor as yourself means in loving yourself, you should be loving your neighbor. Now how does that happen? If you love the part of yourself that is also your neighbor. But if you love the part of yourself that separates you from your neighbor, that makes you you, you love your own fingerprints, well then you're not going to love anybody else's fingerprints. Certainly not as you love yourself. So love your neighbor as yourself means, in the act of loving yourself, as you choose to love yourself, you should be loving them as well, because you're loving the part that we all have in common, rather than the part that makes us all separate and different. One more interesting highlight. In describing the animal soul, Tanya says that it is the animal soul that animates the body, gives life to the body, is contained in the blood, as in the phrase, the soul is in the blood. It's talking about the animal soul. And from this animal soul, we get unholy characteristics. And that's because the soul is made up of four elements, fire, air, water, and earth, and each of the four elements produces a characteristic. Where do we get, for example, anger? What does it mean a human being gets angry? What is anger? Where does it come from? The Rebbe says it comes from the element of fire. Fire is intense and it rises. That's what anger is. When the fire in us is excited, then we become angry or arrogant. So anger and arrogance have a similar characteristic. They are intense and they rise. They're hot. Where does idle thoughts, where does boasting, joking, cynicism, where do these things come from? They come from the element of air. So we see that the elements are not particles, but rather directions, movements, behavior. Fire rises. It creates characteristics that rise. Water runs downhill. It creates those characteristics that drag us down. Air will go anywhere or nowhere. It has no particular direction. It's aimless. Earth is stubborn, resists movement. Air is not stubborn, it's not going up, it's not going down, it's aimless. What kind of a characteristic does this produce? It produces the pleasure that we get from idle talk, from boasting, knowing that it's not true, from joking about things, not taking anything seriously, and from being skeptical. Because being skeptical means not taking a position, not making a commitment. Being doubtful of things comes from the element of air, because it's basically a non-position. I don't know. I doubt it. I doubt that. I doubt it means I will not take a firm commitment, either yes or no. I will remain uncommitted by saying, I'm doubtful. I doubt it. I don't think so. You don't think so really means I have no idea, I don't know. But you don't want to be that committed, so you say, I don't think so. And it comes from the element of air. Now, the element of air produces boasting. How is this different from arrogance, which is produced by fire? The answer is, the person who is arrogant enjoys his, at least imaginary, superiority. He is really convinced that he's superior, and that makes him feel good, makes him feel better about himself. That's arrogance. Boasting is not the behavior of an arrogant person. Boasting is the behavior of an empty person. He does not really believe the things he boasts about. The claims that he makes, the credit that he gives himself, he knows are not true. They're not valid. They're not real. Why then does he boast? It's precisely the emptiness of the boast that gives him pleasure. He enjoys the nonsense of it. He enjoys the non-commitment of not having to be honest, not having to be true, not having to be serious. So he boasts in order to avoid reality, and avoiding reality is his pleasure. So the element of air produces a pleasure that comes from unreality, a pleasure that comes from not making a commitment, a pleasure that comes from the very fact that there is no substance or meaning to what I'm saying. And this is very similar to the pleasure of going to a movie that has absolutely no message. It has no value, it has no substance at all. And it's precisely the lack of substance that makes it enjoyable in an air kind of way. So, taking all four elements together, they produce these directions or directionless behavior that is unholy. In the godly soul also has four elements, fire, air, water, and earth. But in the godly soul, each element produces a valid, holy, and useful characteristic. So, for example, earth, the element of earth, which will produce depression and sadness in the animal soul, will produce humility and patience in the godly soul. The element of fire that produces arrogance and anger, temper, in the animal soul produces in the godly soul a longing, a yearning for better things, for higher things, for greater godliness, greater closeness. And it comes from the element of fire, because fire not only makes for warmth and enthusiasm, which we always associate with fire, but the element of fire also produces dryness. And in that dryness, we experience a thirst. So loving God conventionally comes from water, the element of water. But thirsting for God certainly doesn't come from water. It comes from the lack of water. It comes from the fire. So the fire intensifies the love and introduces into the love an element of thirst, an element of yearning. As King David says, my soul thirsts for you, in a place of desolation where there's no water. And that will be satisfied and completed when Mashiach comes.